Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and I'm here with the one and only comedian Paula Poundstone, who's coming to the Birchmere in Alexandria, Virginia on November 11th through the 13th. Paula, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I'm not sure if I'm going to run this before or after the election, but definitely one day next week, and your shows are the weekend following right after the election. What could we possibly have to laugh about?
Honestly, I feel like the entire country is now like Rosemary and Rosemary's Baby. Like, we know we're giving birth to the devil, but we just want to get it out.
What have you done to its eyes?
That's a horrible, awful process. And just everything, just the whole thing, it reflects badly on all of us. The candidates are from some sort of macabre version of Alice in Wonderland, and I just keep picturing Mike Dukakis and Howard Dean drinking together. Dukakis says, "I had an ill-fitting helmet." Howard Dean says, "I said woo."
Bow.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that took him out of the race. I mean, honestly, at this point, Watergate seems like kind of a dreamlike time.
Yeah, and Howard Dean goes, love
you that. You can talk about having your followers assassinate your opponent, and that doesn't take you out of the race. Go figure.
It's like all the old rules are suddenly thrown out this year.
Well, you know, when I was in the sixth grade, I ran for class president.
And well, congrats.
School politics are a great idea to teach kids about our democracy. It's a great idea. But, of course, the problem in sixth grade is that there are no issues. Mm-hmm. You know, even if you get elected class president, you have no powers. And so it makes for a fluffy speech. So when we made our speeches, me and some other kids too, I think, claimed that if they elected us president of the sixth grade class, that we would get a soda machine in the school. And the teacher took us aside afterwards and said, "Well, you can't say that because that's not true. You wouldn't be able to do that."
But that's what the politicians do.
Exactly, which in no way prepared me for adult politics.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, you should be able to say whatever you want. That's how
honestly. Well, that was back in, I don't know, early 70s, I guess, right? So apparently, you know, we've devolved to where that rule no longer applies.
Awesome. So are you, I assume at the Birchmere, if our listeners turn out, it will be a lot of politics, but do you have to tailor your jokes based on who wins Tuesday, you know? Are you going to have to, you know, change how you deliver some of them?
Oh, I wouldn't think so. The truth remains the truth, regardless of, you know, I shouldn't say the truth, because I don't know what the truth is, to be totally honest with you at this point, but my perceptions remain my perceptions, I should put it that way, regardless of, and even, you know, I'll tell you, I don't tell people what to think. I don't shame them for not thinking what I think. Mm-hmm. I don't tell people how to vote, and if I did, what a strange voter that they would listen. I just, you know, it's just my perceptions, and I always tell the crowd the caveat that I happen to be a Democrat. I always say, but you know, you do whatever you want, and it's just that I happen to have the microphone, and so it's my turn to talk. That's all. And if people don't, you know, if people don't share my views in politics, which they needn't, then I can guarantee you, somewhere within the evening, we will find common ground, because I'm not a political analyst. I wouldn't even call myself a political comic so much as my act is largely autobiographical. And at this point in my life, because my act is largely autobiographical, I do talk about politics, because we're all sort of steeped in it. But I also talk about raising a house full of kids and animals and you know, trying to pay attention to current events well enough to be a halfway decent citizen. And my favorite part of the night is just plain talking to the audience. I do the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living? And in this way, little biographies of audience members emerge. And I use that from which to set my sails. In fact, one of my favorite nights was many years ago at the Birchmere. To my left of the stage, there were these two guys, and I just began talking to them. And one of them worked in the patent office. And so I was finally able to find out why so many patents remain pending. There's always great audience members at the Birchmere. I love it there.
Awesome. Well, speaking of the whole, you know, who are you, where are you from? Weren't you born, you're born in Alabama. I saw you used to bust tables at IHOP. How'd you get into comedy?
Well, you know, it's not like I was turning my back on a law degree. I was lucky. I mean, I had always wanted to be a comic, but I had absolutely no idea where, you know, where the mouth of the trail was. I had no idea how to even begin. Mm-hmm. I thought at one point that I might try being like a street performer in Boston or something, but even that, I wouldn't have had the slightest idea how to begin. But fortunately, in 1979, when I was bussing tables at a salad bar in, which, by the way, at that time was cutting edge, not bussing tables, but the salad bar.
Salad.
at a salad bar in Boston, a couple of guys started up a fledgling, like, right beginning comedy scene, which is supported. I mean, the pool for comics comes from having an open mic scene. So where a club has a night where anybody can go up for 5 minutes, and that's how you begin. I mean, that's college for a stand-up comic. Lots and lots and lots of it. And so I started there doing that, and then I took a Greyhound bus around the country to see what clubs were like in different cities, and ended up in San Francisco, and I never went back to live in Massachusetts after that, even though it is a great state, and I miss it a lot, particularly now.
Speaking of San Francisco, didn't Robin Williams see you out there and give you a nice little break in your career?
He did. He was a big supporter of mine, and by the way, Robin was a big supporter of lots and lots of people. Robin was the most generous man I think I've ever known. And truth be told, really nobody my generation or younger would be doing stand-up comedy at all, likely, were it not for Robin, because he, that sort of resurgence, I mean, stand-up comedy has been around since we came out of the caves, but Robin definitely was the guy who renewed interest in it, audiences' interest in stand-up comedy, starting in the late 70s. I mean, by the time I showed up in San Francisco, Robin was a huge, huge star. He was coming towards the tail end of Mork and Mindy, and he was an enormous star and extraordinary in the way he went about doing what he did. That improvisation and that high energy was just, was huge chunks of fish to the dolphin audience. they loved it. And the thing about him was that he would show up everywhere. And so audiences came out really hoping to see Robin. And in the meantime, they saw the rest of us. And the cool thing about San Francisco was that audiences seemed to really enjoy getting in on the ground floor of different performers. And so I, having been lucky enough to sort of roll in there on a Greyhound bus, it wasn't really something that I planned out mentally and said, here's a great strategy. I just sort of ended up there. And because of that, I got this great base of support, both from Robin and, by the way, Dana Carvey. Dana introduced me. Dana was also managed by the same company Robin was at the time, and they introduced me to their management, and those guys took me on for a while. And the rest will be in the Paula Poundstone Museum, I assume.
Where are you going to set that up?
The cities are making bids now.
It's like the Olympics.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of there's a lot of cheating that goes on as well. A lot of corruption in the process to get the Paula Poundstone Museum in one's town.
Well, hopefully, you know, we'll work all that out, hopefully. Yeah. Awesome. Well, I mean, you've done a lot. I mean, first of all, we got to get Robin Williams one of them Mark Twain prizes posthumously. We got to do it. We just gave it to Bill Murray here in D.C. at the Kennedy Center. We got to do it. As for you, I mean, man, you've gotten a lot of accolades. Comedy Central's 100 Greatest Stand-Ups. I think you won, like, Best Female Stand-Up back in, like, the 80s. I mean, you've done it all yourself. But how many tour dates do you do these days?
I do about 90 a year, yeah. which is a lot in my business. I do it for a couple of reasons. The first is because my job is a really a healing, joyful job. I consider myself a proud member of the endorphin production industry, both for the audience that comes. And by the way, people don't have to come see me, although wouldn't that be nice? But the truth is, being in a group of people laughing is a really mentally healthy thing to do. And it's different, by the way, from watching something by yourself somewhere. The truth is, 99.9% of the times that people type LOL, it's a lie.
It's absolutely.
You don't generally LOL when you're by yourself. You LOL when you're in a group of people. And you saw, a lot of times you laugh at stuff you didn't even get. It's just that the laughter is contagious. And sometimes, I mean, I know, for example, I'm a big, huge Three Stooges fan. Mm-hmm. But when in all the years I've watched them, I've generally watched them alone. And I don't know that I've ever laughed out loud. I've acknowledged in my head that I thought they were funny. Mm-hmm. But when I went to the Three Stooges Film Festival at the historic Alex Theater in Glendale, California, I was caught up in waves of laughter. And sometimes I was laughing at things that, even though I've seen those same shorts 100 times easily, I never saw that particular image or I never paid attention to that particular joke until I heard other people laughing at it. So I'm lucky to get to do a job that just from sheer brain science is good for you. And then the other reason I work a lot is I have a tremendous amount of personal debt. I don't even have a savings account because I don't know my mom's maiden name.
Oh, yeah.
So unless I'm Tony Bennett, you know, I'm going to, you know, I really have to work forever. My son had the nerve to ask me one time what he got when I died. I said, debt. And I said, I want it to go specifically to you, too.
And he gets 14 cats, right?
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking at one time about leaving California. I was walking. We also have two German Shepherd mixed dogs. Right. So I was walking the dogs with my middle daughter one night. And I said, you know, Allie, when you guys all go away to college and everything, I don't have a reason to stay in California. I don't care about California at all. I said, you know, I'll just go to a farm in New Jersey. And Allie goes, Mom, how are you going to get 14 cats across the country to New Jersey? And I'm like, you know what? You're right. I am stuck in California.
Is the idea, how you were saying with the Stooges, and you like being in a communal setting and laughing together with other people around, tie that into, you know, is that why you like, you know, regularly going on Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR? You like being in the group?
Oh, it's great. And, you know, I didn't plan it that way. It just sort of worked out. They called me up and asked me. And it is so much fun. One of the beauties of Wait, Don't Tell Me is that, as far as I know, there's nobody has any sort of big ego about who came up with what joke. And so, you know, we're all sort of there hoping to make the evening entertaining. And so when one person throws out, you know, a joke, everybody sort of piles onto it. And it really is fun. In fact, somebody was telling me one day, I was doing an interview, I think, and somebody was quoting something I had said on Wait, and I go, you know, I think Adam said that. I think I took it. As soon as he said it, I grabbed it from his hands and ran. But I think Adam did say that. Yeah, it's very, very fun. We have the best audiences provided to us by public radio, I must say. But they are smart and game and willing. Everything doesn't come, especially in a show that's improvised the way much of Wait is. The panelists, and there's three of us each week, there's about 15 of us all together, and we rotate in no particular order that I'm aware of. We're asked questions about the week's news by our host, Peter Sagal. And Peter obviously has a script in order to be able to ask the questions and to explain the answers. But for the rest of us, we have no script. We're aware that it's based on the week's news. So I suppose if somebody, you know, was really responsible and did their homework, they could think up jokes ahead of time. As far as I know, no one does.
Yeah.
And we've talked about it before, whether or not we'd want to go that direction and sort of purposely prepare things. And I think everybody to a man said no, because it takes... We just felt like it would take. We didn't want to be pulling a scam.
Yeah.
You know, we wanted the sort of sparks of stuff that come up to be genuine, and so we left it that way, and so far it seems to work. The only two things we know about ahead of time are the bluff story, where there's a real news story, and then there's two other fake news stories. And we write the fake news stories, and so we're told the idea, like what has to be the umbrella topic, that is. Mm-hmm. We're told that the night before. And then the other thing is, a few minutes before we go out, they usually say the final joke, they call it the prediction, that where they go, well, Paddle, if anyone, you know, if that happens, we'll talk about it next week. Right. Wait, don't tell me. That joke right then, we're told the premise, of it. I mean, we're not told what to say, but we're told what the topic is just a few minutes before we go on.
Gotcha. Now, I know we started the interview talking about sort of how you might be doing some political stuff at the Birchmere, but a lot of our younger listeners might not know that of your stuff you did with the Tonight Show with Jay Leno. You were doing backstage presidential stuff back at the 92 campaign, right? What are your memories of that? And how does that campaign relate to, compared to this?
Jeez, can you imagine?
Clinton, still Clinton's, right?
It was the first Bill Clinton election. He ran against the first George Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was exciting and fun. Part of the reason, it was my manager's idea, actually. And she talked to the Tonight Show, and they went with this idea. And it was simply for me to do backstage coverage at the conventions. I did the Democrats, I think, were in New York, and the Republicans were in Houston, as I recall. And then I went back. It was so successful that they had me go to the inauguration as well.
Awesome.
And I did, four nights for each of the convention and four nights of the inauguration. And I knew very, very little about politics. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I had ever watched more than a few minutes of a convention ever. and that was part, I think, of the reason that it worked, was that I was genuinely mystified by much of what I saw, by what theater it is, I think. I mean, I had this idea that, I don't know, that things were more organic than they were. For example, I was just blown away to see hand carts, dollies, of huge stacks of campaign signs be brought in. I had this idea. I mean, now you can tell when you look, you can certainly see that they all look the same. And right. I guess you could that at that time too. But I thought people brought their own kids. They made them in their garage with spray paint because they were so enthusiastic. It never occurred to me that the campaign itself brought them in. Well, how phony is that? That's like a thank you on your receipt from Burger King. it really, a lot of it is such theater. And the other thing is, anybody who talks during the day, no one is listening. they try to put the camera so you can't tell as a viewer on television. But, somebody who has like a day slot speaking or early evening speaking at the convention, not one person on the convention floor is listening to them. They all just sort of are in conversation and doing whatever. Around 8 o'clock or so, they stop being rude. But before that, they pay no attention. So to have an early speaking spot is more like, I don't know, going through the spanking tunnel. So there's something punitive about it. It's like a horrible thing. I guess they do it to sort of forge themselves or something nothing that happens can bother them.
Yeah, why do they have to be so stinking long? It doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't make sense. It's very odd.
Yeah.
The whole thing is very odd. But anyways, it was really fun to do, and it did culminate in being able to go cover the inauguration, yeah. Which was also really, really fun.
How much?
I remember the Tonight Show, they were annoyed that I didn't get an interview with Bill Clinton. And I finally just said to them right on the air, it's the inauguration.
He's busy.
It's the inauguration of the President of the United States. Maybe that's more important than the Tonight Show. Maybe. Yeah.
How much did you actually work with Jay Leno, or did they just kind of turn you loose when you were out there to do
your
own thing?
They inadvertently turned me loose. The truth is, if I did that same thing now, or if anybody, and I'm sure they've had roving reporter kind of stuff since then. But the timing of what happened was, Jay had just gotten The Tonight Show.
Mm-hmm.
Helen Kushnick, who was his manager and became the executive producer or whatever on The Tonight Show, was still with him. And they really had just arrived, and they didn't yet have their sea legs. And they were, I think, so overwhelmed by what they had to do to run this, you know, 4 or 5 night-a-week show, which is a tremendous amount of work, that once they got me, they didn't have time to really pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to do whatever I wanted. And NBC had gotten us, or The Tonight Show, I guess, had gotten us credentials for the convention floor. But the problem is, credentials for the convention floor come in different gradations.
Mm-hmm.
There are some where, you know, you can go near the building. And then there's stronger credentials where you can go down on the convention floor, right?
Mm-hmm.
NBC, or The Tonight Show, or whoever it was so powerless at the time that they got me the most useless credentials. So I could barely get in the building with what they had. So my manager and I, when we were the only two, you know, we borrowed news cameras to do it. I mean, we had no crew, we had no staff. It was just me and my manager, and we would spend the day networking to get better credentials. In fact, usually I dress up to go on stage, but there's one of the appearances that I did where I'm just in like a short sleeve shirt and a denim jacket because I didn't have time to get back to the hotel in between networking to get better credentials. And so they so The Tonight Show itself couldn't complain when they talked to me. You know, they couldn't say, well, we didn't know what you were going to do, or blah, 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 or you have to tell us what you're going to do, because we couldn't know what we were going to do because we couldn't figure out how close we could get. And in the end, we brought them some pretty darn good stuff. It was really, really fun. In fact, I believe I used to use Maria Shriver's headset. And there's a some sort of thing that clicked around your waist. And let me tell you, I was pretty thin back then, and it was still about 4 inches too small for me. She was a wafer thin person. but anyways, yeah, it was really a fun time, and very adventurous, you know, especially because I knew nothing about all of this.
Awesome. And it's perfect preparation for what you're doing at Birchmere. Before you go...
It is, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. I became more and more confident during this process where I really couldn't control the fact that I didn't know what I was going to say. where it's the playground of what I do. It is the heart and soul of what I do. Is the part of just talking to the crowd and not really knowing where things are going to go. I just have a certain confidence after 37 years of doing this job that I'll stumble on somebody who's really fun to talk to. And by the way, that's 99.9% of the people who come through the door.
Absolutely. Well, we encourage all our listeners to definitely come check it out. And also, I think you got like a double live album, North by Northwest, that's out as well.
Came
out in the summer, yeah. So lots of ways to see and hear Paula Poundstone, but check her out at the Birchmere in Alexandria on November 11th through the 13th. Thanks so much. You're more than generous with your time and hilarious as always. We'll see how the election goes, and plenty of material for you.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Take care.
All right. Take it easy.